This is a great tragedy and loss for us, the search and rescue community, and for the state of Alaska.
Alaska state troopers aren't speculating on what caused a helicopter to crash near Talkeetna over the weekend. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the sequester takes a toll on the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
It's this advanced warning that really begins to be lost when the ground-based monitors are no longer maintained.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical in-office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com.
Alaska state troopers have released the names of three men killed in a trooper helicopter crash near Talkeetna over the weekend. In a somber and sometimes emotional press conference today in Anchorage, Public Safety Commissioner Joe Masters said that Hilo 1's pilot Mel Nading, Trooper Tage Toll of the Talkeetna Post, and a body believed to be that of snow machiner Carl Ober were aboard. Masters said the rescue call came in late Saturday night, and at about 10 p.m., the helicopter crew radioed that they had located the missing snow machiner.
At approximately 2200 hours, radio communication with Hilo 1 indicated that they had located the injured snow machiner, tentatively identified as 56-year-old Talkeetna resident Carl Ober. It was requested that a ground ambulance be waiting at the Sunshine Tesoro in Talkeetna to meet up with Hilo 1 to transport Mr. Ober to a hospital for treatment. Hilo 1 did not make the rendezvous.
After the helicopter failed to show up, additional troopers were dispatched by snow machine and the Air National Guard was called in. Guard searchers located the wreckage of the helicopter about 9:30 a.m. Easter Sunday.
Two pararescue jumpers were lowered down to the scene. The two AWT troopers were on scene shortly thereafter. An assessment of the scene was conducted, and it was determined that there were no survivors from the crash of Hilo 1. Due to the condition of Hilo 1 and the on-scene investigation, the recovery of remains occurred later in the day. Positive identification of the remains is still ongoing. At this point, we will not speculate as to why Hilo 1 crashed. The NTSB will conduct an investigation into the cause and circumstances.
Master says the crash represents a great tragedy for the troopers and the search and rescue community as well. Trooper Director Colonel Keith Mallard says that Pilot Nading was hired in 2000 and had flown more than 3,000 hours and saved hundreds of lives during his time with the troopers in Alaska. He says Nading had over 12,000 hours in the air prior to coming to work for the state troopers.
In 2012, Mel Nading made over 900 contacts, so it's reasonable to think that he flew over 900 missions.
The crash marks the 14th and 15th trooper deaths in the line of duty since 1974. Hilo 1 was the only helicopter of its type in the state. A second helicopter has been requested by the troopers, but that will depend on a legislative appropriation. It will cost more than $3 million. The EPA is scheduled to release its revised watershed assessment for the proposed pebble mine in Bristol Bay sometime this spring. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, conservation groups are stepping up the lobbying pressure in Washington in anticipation of the ruling.
There are a whole host of groups who oppose the pebble mine, from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation down to independent subsistence fishermen. But the sheer volume of mineral resources and the hundreds of billions of dollars in possible revenue have enticed many to support the mine.
It's of a size that they've told their shareholders is three times bigger than the biggest mine in North America.
That's former Alaska State Senate President Rick Halford at a happy hour outside of Washington, D.C. for conservationists. The Republican has been an outspoken critic of the mine, saying there's no way an open pit mine of Pebble's magnitude could coincide with the world's largest red salmon fishery. Halford, who represented Chugiak in the state Senate, has both personal and commercial interests in Bristol Bay. He owns a cabin and ran an outfitter service in western Alaska. He says the Pebble Partnership needs to step forward and submit its application for a permit.
Hiding behind that we haven't applied yet, when they have the Wardrop report that they paid for and filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission, when they have their water rights application that's hundreds of pages long to take all the water in both forks of the Coctulee and Upper Tulare Creek, they have a lot on paper.
The Wardrop report is a study from Northern Dynasty, one of the companies involved with the mine. Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively says the Wardrop report is a framework. It does not contain essential environmental guidelines. Those guidelines would be in a final permit application. Shively would not pinpoint how far along the company is in its application, nor would he say when precisely it will submit its plan to the government.
We're a good ways. It's possible we would have a project description out this year. I mean, I've said that every year since I've been CEO, and that's been 5 years, but I think we're getting close.
Shively says the Pebble Partnership has spent more than $100 million researching possible environmental effects. He says he met with EPA administrators in Seattle 3 weeks ago, and agency officials say a draft assessment is due this month. It would be open for public comment, and the agency would review the comments before issuing a final decision. Jay Bellinger is the former manager of the Kodiak Island National Wildlife Refuge. He and more than a dozen other retired government employees, from the state DNR to the Fish and Wildlife Service, fired off a letter to the president. They want President Barack Obama to intervene and block the mine. Bellinger, who now lives in South Dakota, says he can't believe the federal government, for which he worked for decades, would grant a permit.
I'm flabbergasted that something like this could be proposed in America, and especially in the pristine habitat in Western Alaska, where there's very little of it left in the world, and not even necessary for human survival.
Unnecessary because the mine would rip copper, gold, and other valuable metals out of the earth, not oil and gas. Bellinger, who was also visiting D.C., says conservation groups in Alaska cannot prevent the mine alone.
People have joined together that aren't always on the same page, you know, to try and stop this thing, but they can only do so much. The Alaskans, and they've got to get groups down here in the lower 48 to stand up and be counted.
And that's where Tom Franklin comes in. Franklin works with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. He says his group of sport fishing companies, guides, and outfitters from all over the country is increasing pressure on Congress to block the permit. He says the Alaska congressional delegation has not led on the issue.
They're fence-sitting a little bit right now. I think they recognize the volatility of this issue.
Franklin says many in Congress don't know much about the issue, in part because the mine would be on state land. But the EPA has an interest in the water quality in the region, and the area surrounding the state land is controlled by various federal agencies. He says the EPA could nix any mine outright.
It's not necessary to wait for a permit application. We know that the scale of this development would be so great that it would have a huge impact on water quality. And that's what EPA is primarily concerned about.
With the agency about to undergo a leadership change, it's unlikely any decision will come in the next few months. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The state Senate unanimously passed the governor's crime package today. The bill is meant to combat Alaska's high rates of domestic and sexual violence, says North Pole Republican John Coghill.
We have a problem in Alaska. This is some forward motion on ways to protect the victims, hold criminals accountable, and give good process for them to work. I think it's at least a good place to work on right now.
The bill amends criminal code in dozens of ways, focusing especially on sex crimes. It gets rid of a statute of limitations for human trafficking and child pornography. It allows for wiretapping in trafficking cases. It makes it so persons charged with stalking or domestic violence could be ordered to wear GPS monitors. It also makes it a third-degree felony for a probation or parole officer to have sex with someone in their charge. That provision is in response to a case where a state officer had women perform sexual acts in exchange for covering up probation violations. The officer was only charged with official misconduct and bribery. Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican, described that case as horrific.
Just because somebody has committed a crime and might be on probation or parole, we don't allow them to be further sexually violated.
One controversial provision of Governor Sean Parnell's original bill was removed during the committee process. Lawmakers got rid of language that would have imposed criminal penalties on volunteers for sports teams if they didn't report suspected child abuse. A companion bill is in its final committee review in the House. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, misperceptions about living in rural Alaska.
I think a lot of them get a lot of culture shock when they first come into a town like Kotzebue or smaller villages.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory is joining the list of agencies that have announced reductions in response to the massive federal spending cuts known as sequestration. As KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, AVO will stop maintaining its seismic networks on some remote volcanoes.
Late last year, scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory picked up a swarm of small earthquakes at Little Sitkin Volcano in the far western Aleutians. They would have been undetectable to humans, but were picked up by AVO's seismic network on the volcano and alerted scientists to the possibility of an eruption. The closest community is 200 miles to the east and wouldn't have been affected, but an eruption could have caused problems for international flight traffic. Little Sitkin eventually calmed down, but now things are a little too quiet. The volcano's seismic network isn't transmitting data, according to geophysicist Jeff Freimuller.
Some of the stations are probably working just fine, we just can't hear them. The data don't get back to us.
Freimuller thinks the problem is with the network's receiver on nearby Amchitka Island, but he says it's impossible to know without getting out there, and that isn't going to happen anytime soon.
When the USGS budget gets cut, all parts of AVO are run short.
Last year, AVO's budget was about $4.5 million, 40% less than 5 years ago. This year's budget is still being sorted out, but it's expected to be considerably smaller because of sequestration. Freimuller says that's why the organization announced Friday that Little Sitkin and two other volcanoes' networks will remain offline for the foreseeable future.
We've got about 25 different networks, and so that means you should be going to, you know, doing service at five or six of them every year, and we've probably been doing closer to half that. And things start breaking.
Networks in the populated areas of the Aleutian Islands and Cook Inlet will continue to be high priorities for maintenance. But Freimuller says other, more remote networks that go offline may have to stay that way. AVO will continue to use remote sensing, infrasonic networks, and pilot observations to monitor their activity. And in Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory is celebrating its 25th anniversary today. It was created in 1988, 2 years after a large eruption of Augustine Volcano near Homer created problems for the Anchorage area and the airport. The next year, in December 1989, Mount Redoubt erupted, sending an ash plume more than 30,000 feet in the air. When a passenger jet on its way to Anchorage encountered the ash, it lost power to all four engines. The airplane plummeted nearly 20,000 feet before the pilots were able to regain control and land safely in Anchorage. John Power is the scientist in charge of AVO and has been with the agency since its first year. He says that dramatic airline incident highlighted one of the main hazards from volcanic ash.
That particular event really propelled what we do in Alaska and internationally to deal with volcanic eruptions, particularly those that produce these large ash plumes. That particular event spawned a whole number of efforts to educate pilots about how to deal with the hazards from volcanic ash. The airline industry, you know, large engine manufacturers, aircraft manufacturers began to take it much more seriously at that time. The Volcano Observatory here, we worked very hard with, you know, for example, the Airline Pilots Association, the International Air Carriers Association, to develop warning protocols to help keep aircraft and volcanic ash separated. And we've been fairly successful here in the North Pacific at doing that. There are a whole number of other efforts involving other federal and state agencies to try and come together and deal with that problem at that time. And really, we've been very successful over 25 years in keeping these two aircraft and volcanic ash separated.
How much has AVO's network of seismic and other monitoring instruments expanded since then?
When we first began, we were really a very small program. We really only looked at Mount Spur, Mount Redoubt, Mount Illiamna, and Augustine, really those volcanoes right here in south central Alaska. As the need and the hazard for understanding volcanic ash plumes expanded, we began to expand into the Alaska Peninsula and into the Aleutian Islands. Of the 52 historically active volcanoes in the state, we eventually began to operate seismic instrumentation, on-the-ground instrumentation, on 32 of those 52 historically active volcanoes.
Besides monitoring volcanoes, the AVO does a lot of research on volcanoes around the state. Describe some of those projects and what the goal is with that type of research.
Sure. What we're interested in the observatory, or what we say our mission is to understand and warn of hazardous volcanic activity. We have a big program of monitoring volcanoes in real time, but we also are very, very interested in how the volcanoes have behaved in the past. We perform a whole number of geological studies looking at, when these volcanoes have erupted, even prehistorically, how big was the eruption? How far did the ash fall? Is this volcano likely to impact communities at great distance? Is this volcano, have very infrequent but very large eruptions? Does it erupt all the time? We perform a whole number of geological investigations associated with those, and we've done that, at many, many of the volcanoes in the state at this point in time, although we still have a great deal more to learn.
How challenging is it to maintain the same level of service during this time of federal sequester and other budget cutting?
It has been difficult for us. We have seen declines in our budget. We've had to do some things like defer some of our maintenance. It is very expensive to operate most of the instrumentation that we place on these volcanoes. As we all know, Alaska has a lot of remote areas. Our volcanoes are very remote. It's very expensive to access them. All of our sensors are, designed to have a long life. We have a 3 to 5 year maintenance turnaround on them. They're all solar powered. But it is very expensive. And with the economy as it is and declines in the federal budget, most of AVO is funded through an appropriation to the U.S. Geological Survey. We have had to defer maintenance, and we are at this point in time struggling in some areas to keep all of our instruments operational.
In light of what you talked about as far as the scientific value going back and knowing the history of eruptions and how that might kind of give information for future eruptions with volcanoes, what's lost when you have to take some of these monitors offline as far as that continuity in history and also for public safety when you can no longer keep some of them maintained and operating?
Right. The way that the whole thing works, when these instruments are no longer in operation, we, of course, lose our long-term baseline force of observation. It's sort of, a good analogy to think about here is when you go to the doctors, he takes your blood pressure, looks at a lot of things, he keeps a long-term medical history going. We begin to lose some of that when these instruments go offline. When they go off completely, then what we've lost is our ability to what we call forecast or give advance warning of an erupted, of a potential eruption. We still maintain a number of instruments around the state that will allow us to detect eruptions. And we use satellite imagery and we monitor that daily so we usually can detect eruptions after they've occurred, but it's this advance warning that really begins to be lost when the ground-based monitors are no longer maintained.
John Power is the scientist in charge of the Alaska Volcano Observatory. AVO is celebrating its 25th anniversary today.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
After a seven-month-long stay at the Homer Harbor, Buccaneer Energy's jackup rig Endeavor left Ketchumak Bay Friday morning. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the company plans for the rig to drill in the Cosmopolitan Unit near Anchor Point.
The city of Homer asked Buccaneer Energy to move the Endeavor rig to make way for a fender replacement project at the harbor's deepwater dock, where the rig has been moored since last August. Homer Harbormaster Brian Hawkins says the materials for the project have arrived from Seward and are in place on the dock. Jay Brandt Construction of Homer is the contractor in charge of the project, which is expected to take about a month to complete. The Endeavor was given a certificate of compliance by the U.S. Coast Guard over the weekend. Meanwhile, another Cook Inlet jackup rig, Fury operating Alaska's Spartan 151, received the same certificate last Tuesday from the dock in Port Graham. The examinations included verification of the rig's documentation, safety equipment, machinery installations, and watching the crew perform fire and abandoned ship drills. Coast Guard Inspector Jay Jerome says certificates of compliance are issued to all offshore drilling units before they can get to work. Calls and emails to Buccaneer representative Jay Marakis were not returned in time for this story. In a news release earlier this month, Marakis said the Endeavor had also received permitting approval from the American Bureau of Shipping to move to the Cosmopolitan Unit near Anchor Point. Before the Endeavor can drill at Cosmo, however, it still must receive approval from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Traveling outside, many of us encounter questions about Alaska stemming from curiosity and ignorance. Do we live in igloos? Is it always winter and always dark 6 months of the year? Is American money accepted? But rural Alaska residents often feel their urban-dwelling fellow Alaskans have just as many misperceptions about their bush homes. As part of our ongoing series looking at how we define our culture and live our lives as Alaskans, Len Anderson presents these examples.
For over 60 years, Inupiaq Chester Ballot has lived above the Arctic Circle in the coastal community of Kotzebue, located in northwest Alaska. Ballot says people can comprehend 60 below, but they have a hard time grasping that some upriver communities can experience 90 degrees in summer.
And the light, you know. The people ask, it gets dark up there 6 months a year. And it says, no, we can go up on the hill, on Cemetery Hill. If it's a clear day, we can look at the sun for an hour and 43 minutes on the shortest day of the year. And we can just admire it. Or, on the opposite, during the summertime, you can see the sun for 44 days, beginning in early June and ending in July.
Another misconception? Just because northerners live in the Arctic does not mean they like to be cold. Inside their wall tents, out camping, or their homes in town, they're adept at keeping warm, even in houses that may look like shacks to some outsiders. Hadley Ferguson has lived most of her life in Kotzebue. She says urban residents who visit are surprised by the older housing which still remains.
I think a lot of them get a lot of culture shock when they first come into a town like Kotzebue or smaller villages. They're used to the nice fancy houses and they come and see, their first perception is that they're shacks. But they don't understand that a lot of that is due to weather conditions. And you go inside the home and they're beautiful. I've heard them talk and say that's one of the biggest shocks that they had.
Carl Weisner grew up in the northwest Alaska village of Shungnak and now lives in Kotzebue. He says urban Alaskans have a theoretical grasp of higher bush prices, but the reality still produces a wallet shock.
When folks from the urban area come to the Northwest Arctic, they expect that the cost of living is equivalent to their experience, and it's just not. We have to pay greater than $10 a gallon in some villages for gasoline.
On the positive side, Wisner says many visitors are surprised at the closeness existing in rural communities, a bonding that extends beyond family.
It's necessary because in order to overcome some of the challenges like the extremely harsh winter and cold weather conditions or other challenges in the country, we have to cooperate and we have to communicate and work together in order to make something happen.
For several years, Dean Westlake has worked on rural economics and development. Westlake, a former Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly member, says one urban misperception grates on him more than others. It's the accusation that rural Alaska is an economic drain on state finances. He adds his response is his own, not necessarily any official position.
We need to think through this and understand where the resources come from, and I don't mean that in a negative way. Who subsidizes who here? Really should be the question. It's when we say, oh, rural Alaska is the drain, oh, buddy, rural Alaska is the resources. Let's get that straight right now.
Sometimes the difference between urban and rural lies in how one views the same situation. In Kotzebue, the thick ice on the Sound will remain solid into June, while in the town itself, scattered snow piles resolutely resist the long daylight hours. Visitors can find the scene disturbing. Snow and ice in June? Not so for the locals.
And during the springtime, well, June, when the ice breaks up, you hear the crinkling of the ice floating by there and the sun just not setting. To me, it's indescribable to be here and enjoy it, to watch it, and to live here. It's great. It's home.
In just a few months from now, Chester Ballot will again walk along the shore every evening, taking in that exhilarating, comforting panorama. For Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyson on Alaska, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Len Anderson in Kotzebue. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference is May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Take advantage of the early bird registration before March 29th. There's more information online at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.